Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on air. On tonight's program, we learn about the special considerations required when caring for overweight patients.
They bring with them comorbid conditions, which are health conditions that their obesity directly affects. These are diseases that the obesity really makes worse.
Plus, a specialized nursing program for the care of elderly patients.
They are more, you know, sensitive to different medications. They are more prone to be readmitted after a discharge and have side effects that are different just from the younger populations.
And what is the American Nurse Project? Join us for a fascinating exploration. We'll get expert advice for athletic coaches and hear a poignant selection from our healing muse. Well, that's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we focus on the nursing profession, from how they're training to take care of the growing elderly population to how an award-winning filmmaker has captured the essence of nursing in her film, The American Nurse Project. But first, the challenges to our healthcare workers of caring for overweight and obese patients. More than 60% of adults in the United States are overweight or obese, and obese persons are more likely to be ill than those who are not. Obesity presents challenges to physicians and patients and also has a negative impact on their health status. In addition, these patients present some special challenges to the healthcare workers who care for them. We'll hear with more on this as registered nurse Casey Hammerly. She's the program coordinator for the bariatric surgery program at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Casey. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So the numbers of overweight and obese patients has really grown, I guess, in the last several decades. Tell us a little bit more about that.
It has. Across the United States, we have been faced with what some people have termed an obesity epidemic. It is prevalent both in adults as well as children. And this is really interesting to see from the CDC standpoint. The country continues to get heavier and heavier and heavier.
And obviously, there's a lot of issues that go along with that. What are some of the specific health problems that people who are overweight face? There's been a lot of talk about increased diabetes. Tell us more about that.
We see people who come to healthcare who are overweight, they bring with them comorbid conditions, which are health conditions that their obesity directly affects. Things like obstructive sleep apnea, diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, degenerative joint disease. These are all diseases that the obesity really makes worse, and people struggle more with.
And in some cases, is it actually the cause? In other words, the fact that somebody is morbidly obese is the cause of their diabetes?
That is being debated right now on a national level, but yes, there is scientific proof right now that we're kind of unsure which comes first. Does the type 2 diabetes cause someone to become obese, or does the obese person then become a type 2 diabetic?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, it sounds to me like this is, as you mentioned, potentially an epidemic, and everyone's trying to literally get their arms around this to try to figure out how to prevent some of this. But nevertheless, with the fact that two-thirds of Americans are facing this problem, what special challenges are the healthcare workers faced with when caring for an obese patient?
Being a nurse, my answer to that question comes from the nursing perspective. And as nurses in a hospital, we often struggle with caring for patients in a way that is empathetic. We struggle. There is a lot of press given around weight stigma. And sometimes the healthcare worker is the same as anyone else, and they have some of those emotions in their own heart. And so
you're saying they may actually carry this weight stigma. They may feel that the obese patient is to blame
or has had a lot to do with their own condition. As nurses, we have to really kind of put those emotions in check, meet the patient where they are on their healthcare continuum. And so once the nurse is able to do that and able to recognize that this is a patient who just needs some help, the challenges then become things like proper kinds of equipment. Larger patients need wheelchairs that are wider, for example. They need lifting equipment that is capable of heavier loads than some of the standard in-house patient equipment that we use. So if the equipment is available for the nurse to use, sometimes the nurse has not been trained on how to use it. So those are two nursing challenges that I see on the floors in our hospitals today.
It also has been suggested in some of the things I came across that obese patients or very overweight patients may also be less likely to seek out certain preventative services like pelvic exams or pap smears, and they may also, as a result, delay medical care in general because of their own feelings of or concerns about disparagement by physicians and healthcare workers. Have you seen that as well?
I have. There are a lot of people in our community that essentially avoid healthcare for exactly the reasons that you're talking about. There is a, back to the weight stigma, there is a sense that they will be mistreated because they face it in everyday life. The media portrays a image that one should be thin and one should be fit. And for a very obese person, there's the idea that when they come to a healthcare setting, they might be not treated as well as they could be.
But in addition to that, are there actually physical barriers by their size to adequate, for example, physical examination or even palpation of abdominal pelvic organs, those kinds of things? I mean, just the mere size, does that affect the way they are examined and perhaps the ability to determine or discover medical issues, potential
Absolutely.
Problems?
Absolutely. Again, from the nursing perspective, we auscultate, which means put a stethoscope on a patient's chest. And there is more tissue between the skin and the heart. And so in that example, it's harder to hear the accuracy of the heart sounds. And so, yes, assessment is impacted by the obese.
Do you also find, though, we've been talking about their fear perhaps of disparagement, that these patients and maybe delay medical care, but also may have, because of poor self-esteem, potentially depression, some of the things you've mentioned, how does it manifest itself in terms of compliance, the ability to adhere to things the doctors ask them to do, or even self-care? Are you seeing that as well?
Yes, we do see that. Patients struggle sometimes with some of the most basic needs, things as simple as keeping their bodies clean and dry becomes a challenge if their skin folds are so large that their arms are not physically able to get underneath that fold, keep it clean and dry. And so things, mechanical things, do impact how the obese person lives day to day.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with registered nurse Casey Hammerly. She's the program coordinator for the bariatric surgery program at Upstate Medical University. We're talking about the special challenges that overweight or obese patients have themselves and present to healthcare workers or providers. So, as we were saying, it's difficult to actually provide this kind of healthcare treatment to overweight mm-hmm. patients for many of the reasons, both in terms of their size and the needs in terms of the supplies and equipment. And they're maybe not always available. Is there special help for nurses currently in place, for example, in your program, to train these nurses as to how to manage this equipment, to secure this equipment, and help provide for these patients?
The answer to that is yes. There are opportunities for nurses to learn more about safe patient handling, which includes the equipment as well as how to assist a larger patient as they ambulate in the hallway. We have here at Upstate opportunities for nurses to learn through a variety of methods. One of the methods that I personally have been involved with is a Blackboard, which is kind of an asynchronous learning. The nurse is able to log on to a computer-based web learning system, and they look at how to care for the large patient, including the safe patient handling, including some challenges that they might not have even thought about before. For example, as a patient's body becomes more and more obese, their center of gravity changes. And as a patient's center of gravity changes, the patient is at a higher risk of falling while walking in the hallway.
So there are very special accommodations then you must be prepared to make.
Correct.
How about things like providing larger sized examination gowns, armless chairs, all those kinds of things? Are they becoming more readily available?
They are. There are many vendors out in the marketplace who do now have larger gowns and equipment to care for the patient, both durable medical equipment as well as some of the supplies. Things as simple as socks that fit their feet while they're here in the hospital.
What do you think, in general, as a result of what you've seen so far, is most helpful in the advice that you may give to your patients who may be dealing with a lot, you know, being obese or just very, very overweight?
I have learned so much from this patient population. They have really rewarded me by teaching me things like many of them have adaptive equipment in their own home. And I...
Can you give us examples of what
sure.
that means?
Sure. There was a patient I took care of who her son took a commode and actually lowered it by sawing the legs off the not completely off, but he lowered the height of the commode for her. And so this facilitated her getting to the commode at the bedside as opposed to having to use a bedpan or walking all the way to the bathroom. And so this lower commode was something that she brought with her to the hospital. And I thought, wow, that's a really great idea. Here's a person who has had a struggle and has found a solution to her struggle. And she also taught me things like sometimes the bed, the height of the bed is a challenge for a shorter person. Her son, again, built her these platforms that she would step on the platform to be able to get herself into the bed. That commode and platform she brought with her when she was admitted to the hospital.
So is that part of something you would advise your patients to do if they knew they were coming in for a hospitalization, to try to bring adaptive equipment along
Absolutely.
With them?
Absolutely. If they have it at home and it works for them, I would encourage people to bring that kind of equipment with them.
So go ahead. You were going to say something else?
No, I was just going to kind of tell another little story
sure.
about a patient who also taught me that we're not alone in this. I had the distinct pleasure to work with a woman who was around 800 pounds. And her medical condition became pretty acute. She needed to be admitted to the hospital. She lived in a trailer. And if you can imagine what a trailer looks like, an 800-pound person is not coming in and out of the door of a trailer freely. She truly was homebound. What she did is that she called her local fire company, and that fire company knew of her situation, and they knew that if there were ever a true emergency, that it wouldn't be as simple as opening the front door and assisting this person to walk out the door. They came up with a plan, and they actually had to cut a larger hole in her trailer to get her out. So I would encourage people who are homebound in that type of a situation to give a call to their local fire department so that in case an emergency does arise, the fire company is aware of their situation and better prepared to care for them.
So overall, how do you feel that our hospital or clinics in general and staffing training has changed or is changing to meet the special needs now of such a large number of potential patients?
One thing that I have seen change drastically in the last few years is that we do what I call sensitivity training. And that, again, comes back to the weight stigma and helping healthcare providers meet the patients where they are in their healthcare continuum.
And also perhaps encourage them to have an active life, if possible, and a fulfilling life, obviously,
absolutely,
as much as is possible.
Yes.
Casey, this has been very informative. I appreciate your coming in. My guest has been registered nurse Casey Hammerly. She's the program coordinator for the bariatric surgery program at Upstate Medical University. Once again, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Next up, how nurses are training to care for the growing population of the elderly. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air, Linda Cohen along with you. The demographics in this country are aging. By 2030, there will be about 72 million older persons, more than twice their number than in the year 2000. And their health care requires specialized training and approach. We'll hear with more on how Upstate University Hospital is meeting this need. Our Kelly Dolan, a registered nurse and the coordinator for the NICH program at Upstate Medical University, and Deb Wilson, also a registered nurse and a clinical training specialist, and she's also part of the NICH program. So, Kelly, the NICH program. Caring for older population obviously needs specialized care, and especially when it comes to hospitalization. So what is the NICH program?
Well, the NICH program, NICH actually stands for Nurses Improving Care for Health System Elders. It's a program that is nurse-driven protocols, nurse-driven guidelines. It helps us provide the best care at the bedside for older adults. We define an older adult as being anybody over 65 years old, and we know that right now older adults comprise more than 50% of the healthcare dollars that are spent. So they are our core consumers. They also have very unique needs. Older adults have age-related changes that happen that make them extremely vulnerable to injury and to negative outcomes while they're in the hospital, hospital-acquired infections, falls. So these are the things that we teach the nurses, the special training, so that they can provide the very best care and the very best outcomes for older adults.
So, Deb, basically what you're talking about is that this NICH program, which I understand exists beyond Upstate's University Hospital, and we'll talk more about that in a minute, is an opportunity to train nurses in geriatric training so that they're more prepared to handle this population.
Correct, yes.
So what's involved in the training and why is it important?
They have the NICH program involves what we call a geriatric resource nurse, where it's training that involves quite a bit of education in regards to the needs of the older adult, whereas they are have different issues as far as just the younger adult. They are more, you know, sensitive to different medications. They are more prone to be readmitted after a discharge and have side effects that are different just from the younger population. So it's actually training in prevention of some of these side effects, where we would learn
For example, a patient that comes in for a routine procedure, being an older adult, they're more at risk for having delirium occur, especially if they've got dementia on top of that. And
so I'm going to stop you right there. When we talk about delirium, because mm-hmm. that's something that I've heard that term used more frequently, especially around hospitalization of older patients, help us understand what you mean by that.
So delirium, what happens is you take a person, and it can happen at any age, it just doesn't affect the older adults, they're just at higher risk. You take a person and take them out of their environment and give them medications that alter their mental status, possibly sedate them. They wake up in a different kind of environment. They actually, it's a state that caused them to be confused, to not be able to mentally think like they normally would, and they can become agitated, they become confused, they can behave like, you know, nobody's ever seen them behave before. So, you know,
it's unexpected behaviors.
Yeah, absolutely. And when that happens, sometimes what happens in the older adults is they can become agitated because they don't know where they are and they don't know what's going on.
And that's even if they didn't have a clear dementia prior to hospitalization, right?
Right, that can happen. Dementia just adds on top of that. And part of the training is, too, is sometimes people just blame the dementia for the delirium, and it's actually delirium that might be causing the agitation. So a lot of times we learn to involve the families as well and say, look at what their baseline is and go from that. If this is their normal behavior, you know, at least we know that. But to kind of distinguish between the two different things, sometimes it is difficult. But before we received this training, it was all just kind of blamed on the dementia, I think, for the most part.
So it just underscores how important it is for these older adults to be understood, and for the nurses, who are really the kind of the infantry, they're on the line there, the fighting line, to taking care of these patients, need to really be readied for this population. Is that what this is all about, really?
Absolutely, because if we don't recognize those early signs and we don't use the appropriate interventions, then what we're going to notice is you're going to have more patients falling, or you're going to have patients experience what we call functional decline, which means that they come into the hospital at one level of functioning, and then we're not able to return them back to that same level. We want to prevent functional decline, so we use strategies that have been proven, interventions that have been proven, and we are able to help prevent functional decline, prevent falls, keep our patients safe.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with nurses Kelly Dolan and Deb Wilson, and we're talking about the new efforts at University Hospital to meet the needs of an aging population. So let's get back to what the training involves. How does someone become a GRN, or a geriatric nurse?
The niche website actually has programs that the nurses can go to, we have access to, and they actually have training modules, and it's complete education from anywhere from information on how to keep your older adult patient at their functioning level. We want to keep them, if they come in ambulatory, living independently, we don't want to change that. So the strategies that we can do to keep them at their previous functioning level.
So that's a goal, basically.
Absolutely, yeah.
You referenced the NICHE website. Let's mm-hmm. explain to our listeners. So NICHE is an acronym for what you described, but it's an organization that goes beyond University Hospital. Tell us about that.
Yes, it's nurse-driven, and it's out of New York University. Right now, NICHE has over 500 member hospitals. There are different levels of implementation. So when your hospital first joins NICHE, you're in the early implementation phase, and you work through these different levels. Upstate Hospital just recently achieved the level of designation that's called senior friendly. So we were able to demonstrate to the NICHE organization that we have all the training in place, we have the interdisciplinary teams in place, and we have a multi-arm approach to providing the excellent care for the older adults.
Can you give me an example, Deb, of what you might do as a nurse that's different now that you've been trained in this NICHE program than you might have done before?
Sure. We've had patients come in, say you've got an older adult that comes in for a, you know, minor surgical procedure. They come in, it's probably like a day stay, and then they go home. what happens is sometimes with the medications that they get, that's part of the sedation, they can become over-sedated and maybe a little agitated. Our training showed us that actually there are some medications that absolutely should not be used in the elder, you know, in the older adult population. And we've been able to communicate with the physicians and prevent that, because then what happens is it's kind of a downward spiral. You've got this patient that becomes confused, over-sedated, could even, because of the sedation, aspirate and develop a pneumonia, so they ended up more, you know, bedridden longer. Their function declines. They're unable to get up and ambulate like they were before they came in. So we can prevent that before it even starts.
So you can actually make recommendations to the physicians who are taking care of these patients, perhaps surgeons or whatever, that in this population we know that this type of sedation can really cause more problems than it can
be
helpful.
Yeah. And another thing that we do is we make sure that they, you know, patients come in sometimes and they want to sleep all day, and then they're up all night, and then that adds to their confusion, and it can cause the delirium as well. So we make sure that they're up during the day, lights are on, and then decrease their stimulation at night so they get sleep at night, and then it just kind of all comes together to prevent them from losing any of their function.
So basically, what would you say a patient would see that would be different now that you're involved in the NICHE program, Kelly?
I think the patients would notice that we are sensitive to the age-related changes that they have going on in their body. A NICHE-trained nurse knows the right assessment questions to ask. The patient is already experiencing age-related changes, but they might not know how to talk about those. So a NICHE-trained nurse would, for instance, on assessment, when a patient comes and they're admitted, we might ask some very specific questions related to falls at home. If that is not something that is on the radar of another nurse, then they might not adequately determine what the patient's risk for falls in the hospital
is. And therefore take safety precautions accordingly.
Exactly. And we can also, as we try and transition the patient to get ready for them to go home, we can help them learn what strategies they can put in place at home to even keep them safe at home. So our job doesn't end with their discharge from the hospital. We try to give them some good solid advice on how to stay safe at home as well.
So you were involved in this setting this entire thing up, and I think in doing so several years ago, you did a survey of your nurses. What was that about, and what did you find?
So back in 2011, we took part in an assessment. It was a survey of the nurses that looked at their knowledge related to care of older adults, as well as their attitude related to the care of older adults. And what we found was we were ready for this type of a problem at Upstate. We had some gaps in knowledge that we could benefit from the educational resources that NICHE has. But in our attitudes, we definitely had an openness and a readiness for this education. Our nurses wanted to provide the very best care to older adults, so we were ready in every way for this NICHE program.
So how many nurses currently are trained and involved in the program? On average.
Right now, our efforts have been focused on an inpatient unit at Upstate, as well as the geriatric emergency medicine room over at the community campus, and then our transitional care unit. And I'm sorry, I don't know the number of nurses offhand, but those are the three primary areas where we have nurses that are trained. The vision is for unit champions to be developed so that every floor at Upstate would have one or two nurses who are trained as GRNs, so that when the older adults, you know, because we can't realistically have all the older adults be on one floor or in one area. We recognize that they're all throughout our organization. So the vision is to develop the GRN unit champions on every floor.
And that would basically, they would be kind of a super group, so to speak, of people who would train others and influence the care throughout the entire hospital that
yes.
way. Well, it sounds like an amazing program, something that's very much needed, especially as the population ages. Very briefly, in the little time we have left, any other future plans or thoughts going on? I mean, are you working for another level of designation as part of this entire program?
Yes, there is one level of designation left. So we're on the third level, and there are actually four levels. So we hope to achieve the exemplar level of designation. And we know that to do that, we're going to need to partner with community-based organizations. We're going to need to include patients and families on our steering committee. We're going to need to consider what the community needs from us.
Sounds great all around. It's very, very inspiring. Thank you both for coming in. My guests have been Kelly Dolan. She's a registered nurse, and she's the coordinator for the NICHE program at Upstate Medical University, and Deb Wilson, a clinical training specialist, also part of the NICHE program. Thanks so much for coming in. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Some expert advice from the experts at Upstate. Dr. Brian Rieger, chief psychologist and the director of the Upstate Concussion Center, is here with some advice about what coaches need to know about concussion.
If I were a coach on the sidelines, what I really want to be thinking about is it possible or likely, given what I just saw happen on the field, that my athlete may have had a concussion? And I think there are a couple important points related to that. The first is you have to prepare for that moment. That means educating yourself about what the common signs and symptoms of a concussion are. And there are a lot of tools out there available to keep in your first aid kit, keep it in your pocket. The CDC has an app now, Heads Up on Concussion, that you can download to your smartphone. So one of the things you need to have, so you don't have to try and remember it, is a list of the most common symptoms and maybe some suggestions about what questions to ask. Also, you can use your other players to be your eyes and ears on the field. So you want to have educated your players before the season starts about what a concussion looks like and why it's so important to let you know if they think a kid's not right out there. Have a plan. If you're the only coach and the only adult on the sideline, how are you going to change your attention over to this possibly injured athlete versus managing this game, especially maybe it's a playoff game or even a final game? You're going to be conflicted about where your attention is. You need to have thought about that beforehand and come up with a plan about what you're going to do about that. Maybe you're always going to have that assistant coach or parent that you can wave over and get their help in that moment. Maybe you need to stop the game and ask for a little bit of time to check this athlete out. As a coach, you're not a doctor. We don't expect you to diagnose a concussion. What we do expect is that you have the education and the maturity as the adult in that situation to put the child's safety first and to have a, if you have a strong enough suspicion, to get that child evaluated. We want you to communicate to the parents. So often I hear an athlete who comes in and the kid was told by the coach that they may have had a concussion, but that was never communicated to the parents. And of course, the kids don't always want to tell that to the parents. Again, you have to be the adult in the situation, recognize that putting their safety first, hey, mom and dad, I think your kid might have a concussion. Our recommendation is that you have your child evaluated. And I really would not want to see him back at practice or on the field until that happens. And those are the guidelines that we follow.
Coming up next, a conversation with an award-winning filmmaker about her film, The American Nurse Project. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Link on Air. I'm Linda Cohen with your Healthy Monday Minute for the week of November 17th. Build your battle plan for the holidays. Well, you know, it's easy to fall off the wagon when you aren't prepared for a tough road. Avoid setbacks by identifying tricky situations and planning ahead. Have a backup plan to fit your busy schedule and to accommodate bad weather, so to speak. Think about how you'll handle tempting foods or drinks at family gatherings. Remember, a bit of mental rehearsing can go a long way. Look at your schedule this week. Identify any upcoming challenges to your routine. Brainstorm some effective solutions, or consider how you will balance indulgences with smarter choices throughout this week. If you have a misstep, use it to determine strategies for the next time. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Well, since even before the days of Florence Nightingale, nurses have been with us as the crucial individual that can mean the difference between suffering and peace for the sick and wounded. And here in the U.S., without question, the American nurse has stood out as a key person upon which so much of our outstanding healthcare system depends. Carolyn Jones is an award-winning photographer and filmmaker who has spent the last 3 years interviewing nurses from all over this country for a book and a documentary film entitled The American Nurse. And she's here with us to tell us all about the project. Welcome, Carolyn. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Linda. It's great to be here.
So your project is called The American Nurse. Tell us about it.
Well, the American Nurse Project has really three legs that all support the same goal. And the idea is to raise the volume on the voices of nurses across America. I think people really don't understand what nurses do, and we certainly don't understand the wealth of information they have about us. And I think that the idea here is that we begin to understand that and access the knowledge that nurses have to help guide us through this kind of murky, stagnant water that we have that's the healthcare system here in America. So the project started off with a book, which is a collection of black and white photographs of nurses all across the country, 75 nurses, of photographs and interviews of them on location. And it's also a website that's very lively where you can see and hear the nurses talk about issues that they care about, everything from obesity to too much paperwork to end-of-life issues, all the things that we all really care a lot about. And then the third leg of this effort is really a documentary film where I had an opportunity to follow five nurses and go into the depth of their lives and see them with patients.
Hmm. Is it part of the motivation for this that perhaps you feel or it's felt that nurses are the unsung heroes or heroines either of our healthcare system?
Absolutely. You know, I had a great nurse. I had breast cancer and chemotherapy, and I had a nurse that got me through it. I mean, she was funny and irreverent and somehow knew all the right things to say to me to make me feel better. And I never had a chance or an opportunity to thank her. And I think that's the case with us. We don't, as the public, even going through something like that, really know what nurses know. We think they take your temperature, they take your blood pressure, and that's it. We don't understand the extent of their education or the value of their knowledge.
So you made both a film and a book. Tell us about why both?
Well, I started with a book, and I really, you know, someone said to me the other day that the film is kind of like a love letter to nurses. And I started off wanting to celebrate nurses. That's where I began, and to find out what nursing in America looks like. And I didn't want to just find out what nursing looked like, but I wanted to see the issues that we're all dealing with all over the country, everything from poverty and obesity to end-of-life issues to what are we doing with healthcare in our prison system, returning war veterans. I had all of these different issues that I really wanted to capture. So I started off by finding the nurses that were going to appear in the book. So only 75 could make it in the book, but I'd met...
That's a pretty hefty number.
It was good, but the story was so much richer than that. So thus the website was really born and the interviews there. And then I just wasn't finished. You know,
It morphed.
It did. I kept wanting to go deeper. And once I had taken the photographs of the nurses, I realized that I never saw them really in action with patients. And it's so intimate, and I wanted to get in there and put my camera right in there.
It leads me to the next question, which I often think about because I also take photographs. There's something very, very different in the nature of a still photograph versus a moving film of some kind. And clearly it's been so much written about this, and
sure,
the idea of the you know, capturing the moment in a still photograph can be incredibly powerful, but there's a lot more texture and a lot more depth sometimes that can be gotten from those live you know, intimate moments of motion picture. So what did you find the difference was in your own experience?
Well, I'm a storyteller by nature. That's what I like to do. So in all these mediums, whether it's an interview or a still photograph or a film, I'm always after finding what the story is. My photographs, I shoot with a medium format camera, and I'm an old dog. I still shoot with film, and I love that. And I shoot with a Hasselblad on a tripod, and there's a formality to that that I like very, very much. I wanted to respect and honor all the nurses, and I didn't want there to be anything disposable about the work that I was doing. And I don't shoot much film. I'll shoot maybe one roll of 12 exposures and then that's it. But there's a lot of thought that goes into it, and I like that formality of it all. Film is a completely different animal. When I'm filming, I've got a cameraman who's there operating and kind of going into the places I want to go into, and I'm working with the direction side of it. So it's such a different experience, but I love them together. I love being able to do a book and a film.
So they kind of augment each other.
Absolutely. I mean, I ended up thinking of the book as really good research for the film.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with photographer and filmmaker Carolyn Jones. We're talking about her new project, The American Nurse. And you are here in Syracuse for a showing of this film, but it's also available in many different venues. Can you tell us about that?
It is. Well, we're still in the stage of the film where we're getting it out to theaters all across America. And so you can still find it. We're with Carmike Theaters, and they're showing it in, you know, this is kind of a new way of looking at films, and a lot of the theaters have been transformed to show sports and to show, you know, art events. Mm-hmm. And we've been lucky enough to sort of get in with this group so that the film is being shown a lot. Everything is on our website at www.AmericanNurseProject.com, and you can click on the film and then screenings and see where those are in the country. But you can also download the film, you can buy the DVD, you can buy the book. It's all available right on the website. I really wanted that to be the hub of this, because every single nurse that I've met, whether they made it into the book or the film or not, their voice is heard on the website. And the topics are incredible. The things that nurses are thinking about and dealing with are amazing, which is why I think that the mission, if you will, the passion that I've begun to have with this is that nurses need to be at almost every table, in every board, in every situation that we can think of, because their knowledge is so unique.
With that in mind, the thing that I'm really curious about is, how do you think, or would you have an opinion on how either nursing has changed or your documentation of it has changed with the increase of males in the nursing field?
Oh, I love that you asked that, because we have quite a number of male nurses in the book, and when it came time to do the film, I sort of fudged the statistics a little bit. Two of the five nurses are men, and I think it's really, really important for people to understand how valuable that is to have men entering this industry as well. We have so many misconceptions about nurses. It's goofy. I don't know why people think what we do, but, you know, and I have to say I was guilty of it too. You know, we really don't know what this profession entails. But nurses are part of a very important team, and they do an enormous amount of work autonomously too, which is amazing to see. And we've really highlighted that in the film. But, you know, the two male nurses in the film, one is a home health nurse in the Appalachian Mountains. And this guy, he used to work in a garage, Jason Short, and now he drives his vehicle like up creeks to get to people who are entrenched in their homes. And he cares for them. I mean, you get a story about, you know, poverty in America, the coal miners, and this gentleman who can repair his own car after he destroys it driving up a creek. I mean, it's wonderful.
It's kind of the pioneer spirit translated into nursing.
Heck, he's like MacGyver all over again. You know, they can fix anything under any circumstances. I know, because I drove up a creek with him and we ripped off the front bumper. So I watched him repair that on the spot. And Brian McMillian, of course, is a military nurse, and he's working with a lot of the guys coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, very often having lost limbs, a lot of them dealing with post-traumatic stress. And I think that, you know, there is a huge place for men in the nursing world, and we should get rid of whatever weird stigmas that we've got.
Or stereotypes,
yeah,
or
exactly.
Preconceived notions of
exactly.
What they can do. What do you think you've learned along the way?
Oh, my gosh. You know what I've learned? I've learned that I don't know anything. It's been such a wonderful journey. I actually didn't expect at this stage of my life to learn so much. Nurses know things about us that we have no idea are even there.
You've referred to that several times. Give me an example. What do they know?
They know how we die. And this is crucial.
Pretty profound.
I mean, and as a result of knowing how we die and how we react and how our families react, they know how to help us live better. And why we don't access this is beyond me. But that's the main thing. You know, we're in Syracuse, New York, and I can't come here without thinking about the author George Saunders, mm-hmm. who I'm a huge fan of. And mm-hmm. I was just thinking about it today. You know, he wrote that commencement speech, which was floating all around the internet for a while. And he talked about, you know, you get to a certain stage in life and what's really important. And it's kindnesses. It's the kindnesses that we did or we didn't do as a younger person. Well, I think being with nurses for the last 3.5 years, I've been bombarded with that kind of feeling. They care for others.
And they live compassion, basically.
They do. And it is without judgment, which is incredible in this day and age. They don't care what your political party is. I spent time at the Louisiana State Penitentiary because I was convinced that it wasn't possible that you could really care for people as wholeheartedly if they had committed horrific crimes. And they do. I mean, nurses look at each one of us as though that's someone's child or brother or mother or father or whatever, but that's another human being, and I am not here to judge them. And man, we all need some of that.
Wow. That's really inspiring. Why did you choose, this is just my own interest since I'm somewhat of a photographer, why did you choose exclusively black and white images for the book?
Well, I think that black and white has a certain kind of honesty, and I wanted the portraits to be really portraits and have you look into the eyes of the nurse. But I did want to shoot them on location. So a lot of them are in settings that tell a story. Jason Short, we were just talking about. I mean, I shot him in the middle of a creek holding his little doctor's bag, right? So, but if it had been color, I think that for me, all of the surroundings would have had kind of equal weight as Jason did. But that all drops away a little bit if I really have my subject front and center and looking right into the camera. I'm a big believer in that these are the eyes are to the eyes into the soul. I think it has something to do with growing up in Amish country in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and I was never allowed to photograph any Amish people.
Oh my, yeah.
And so
frustrating.
So I've spent a lifetime kind of wanting people to look right in my camera and right. Let me capture their spirit.
We only have a little bit of time left, but you've done so many other documentaries and films. Tell us about, you had a widely acclaimed book called Living Proof, Courage in the Face of AIDS. Just tell us briefly about that.
Sure. That's probably where my journey into thinking the way I think now really began. I had the privilege to photograph over 70 people, men, women, children, grandmothers, police officers, all different kinds of people that were living with HIV and AIDS in the late 80s and early 90s. And that project became a traveling exhibition and a book called Living Proof, Courage in the Face of AIDS. And this was before the AIDS cocktail, and these people all really knew how they were going to die. So for me, it was profound and incredible to be able to be with them.
Very inspiring work. Both projects are really very inspirational. And I want to thank you so much for coming in and taking this time to chat with us and share some of your insights. A lot to think about, a tremendous amount. And I think people won't look at nurses anywhere the same after either seeing your film or even hearing some of your comments.
I hope that's the case.
So very much. My guest has been award-winning photographer and filmmaker Carolyn Jones, who has spent the last 3 years interviewing nurses from all over the country for the project, The American Nurse. Once again, thanks for coming in. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Patients can be our best reporters telling us how illness feels. San Francisco poet Sharon Preti gives us a rapid-fire but precise description of her own transformation from health to illness in her prose poem called Once. Once I was someone else, no fire down the arm, no tingle in the thumb, no spears to the curve of my cervical spine. I'd never heard of a pathway of nerves termed the brachial plexus. No face to the sky follow the flight of a hawk pain. No slouch in my seat, this movie's so good pain. My body obeyed, sprinted when I said so, twirled on one foot if that's what I wanted. No strokes with the chamois to shine the car pain. No hands to the handlebars, chin up and pedal pain. No whys, how longs, what ifs doing their tap dance on my brain pain. I moved like everybody else on this green gold earth. No dumbbell pain, no skyscraper pain, no heft the load of dirty clothes and you'll pay pain. I thought time was a cut of clay I could squeeze into any shape I cared to see. No cradle the phone, yank the weeds, bag of frozen peas to the scalene's pain. I thought freedom was a pie-shaped sun following me, bursting open on road after road, me licking each finger, knee-deep in the slick stain.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we explore some new research into the genetic underpinnings of childhood psychiatric disorders, plus how regenerative medicine is discovering ways to regenerate retinal tissue and prevent blindness, and the importance of getting your flu shot. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLinkOnAir, that's all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can look for us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Sirio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.